Thanks for coming today. We were going to have, hopefully Natasha Grossman will join us at some point. I know she's on the road today. But in the meantime, I'm going to introduce the amazing Annie Drummond, who is a social worker, an MSW licensed clinical social worker, and the clinical coordinator for mobile integrated health, the mobile integrated health team based out of Shoreline, Washington, in the fire department. So you see her wearing a fire department uniform because she really is an employee of the fire department, and she has an amazing amount of experience. Annie's worked as a clinical social worker, a social work supervisor and manager in the Seattle healthcare community for over 20 years. At the University of Washington Northwest Hospital, she developed the ER social work program at Harborview Medical Center, which is a trauma center in Seattle. She had a decade of experience in the ER, psychiatric emergency, and inpatient clinical teams, and at Evergreen Hospital, where I used to work years and years ago, but I don't think we worked at the same time. She served as an in-home mental health case manager. She also has professional and personal experiences with international adoption of all things, and started working as a theatrical stage manager years ago. So that's a fun fact about Annie that I didn't even know.
It's true.
So welcome, Annie. We're so glad that you could come to this conversation. And as I said, hopefully we'll have Natasha at some point later in our discussion. She may have been mixed up by the time change wherever she is. I don't know. So Annie, so these conversations are really informal. And before we start, Annie, I just would like to go really quickly around the little squares to get a sense of, number one, tell us your name and where you work and what population you're working with. So these are all care managers around the country, and I'll call your name, Barbara.
I'm Barbara Cannon. My company is Answers for Elders. I'm the owner of the company.
Carol?
I'm sorry?
I'm calling on Carol.
Oh, I thought you just called on me.
I'm sorry. I did, Barbara. I'm going to the next person. Yep.
I'm Carol Franzen, Dallas Care Connection. I've been doing care management for elders and younger disabled people for about 22 years in Dallas, Texas.
Fabulous. Sue?
Hi, I'm Sue Coyle. I'm in Appleton, Wisconsin. I am a part of it's called Finding Balance Together, but it's really a falls coalition. And we work closely with some of the fire departments. So just really anxious for this topic and how we can continue to build that.
That's great. Brenda?
I'm in Pasadena, California. I'm a sole practitioner, and I work mostly with older people, dementia, and some developmental disabilities.
Fabulous. Heather?
Hi there. Heather Suri. My company is Pathways in Aging. I'm based in Northern Virginia, but I do have an office in Shoreline, Washington, and Seattle is my hometown where I started my nursing career. So thrilled to be here.
Welcome, Heather. Jeannie?
Oh, hi. It's Jenny.
Jenny Carr. Sorry.
That's Jenny. Okay. I work at Stanford Medical Center. I'm a gerontologist and a certified dementia practitioner and a geriatric care manager. And I manage our memory support program, working with patients who have dementia and other cognitive impairments.
Fabulous. Katie? Oh, you're muted, Katie?
There we go. I'm Katie Spurka. I'm with Collaborative Care Coordination and Fiduciary. I work with seniors and elders, and I'm in Northern California in Sonoma County.
Welcome. Diane? Diane,
This is Diane Losachek. I'm also in Shoreline, Washington, and I'm with Active Aging and Care Transitions.
Fabulous. Dr. Kim Evanoski.
Hi, I'm Kim Evanoski. I cover 24 counties in upstate New York with Care Managed for All, and we serve everybody with disabilities and in aging.
Okay, and Venus, CPC Coalition.
Hello, everyone. Venus Allen here, social worker based out of Charlotte, North Carolina, and a certified care manager. Good day.
Chris?
Chris Rosefranks, care manager at CSC Fiduciaries. So I'm a care manager for a fiduciary firm, and I coordinate care and oversee everything for conserved and private care management clients in Walnut Creek, California.
Wonderval. Valerie?
Valerie wrote in. She doesn't have a microphone, so she's a geriatric care manager and works with EMS.
Okay, workers. Great. Thank you. Helen? Helen, can you be on the line? I saw your, Helen is in Colorado. And she's working in quality and safe as a quality and safety practitioner. David, I saw you. Your computer doesn't have a microphone or a camera, and you're a corporate partner at the Aging Life Care Association, and we're glad to have you. Dana?
Yes, I'm Dana Chapman, and I am based in Atlanta, north of Atlanta, in Gainesville, Georgia, and I am a care manager with Premier Care Management of Georgia. And right now I'm the only social worker on a team of RNs. That's good. That's good. That's good.
It is good.
Yeah. Gladys?
I'm Gladys Harris. I'm in private practice in Northern New Jersey working with adults who are aging, developmentally delayed, have incurred a traumatic brain or spinal cord injury.
Thank you. And then do I see a 206? Is that Natasha? Who's got our 206 number?
It is. It's me. I'm sorry. I've been trying on multiple devices to get on this meeting, and it just keeps telling me that the link is invalid. So I'm sorry that I'm not on.
Okay, no problem.
But I'm here.
Natasha, thanks. I'm going to introduce you. Natasha is our second guest. Natasha is a social worker, and she's the program manager for Bellevue Fire Cares, a program that provides resources to vulnerable populations served by first responders. Before joining Bellevue Fire Cares, Natasha was a faculty member and program director at the University of Washington School of Social Work. She has over 25 years. And by the way, I've known Natasha since we went to high school together. So that tells you, you know, she is younger than me, but she's old too. She has over 25 years of experience in direct service, policy, advocacy, program implementation, management, and evaluation, as well as grant writing. Natasha was the founder of Walk a Mile program that educates policymakers about issues facing the most vulnerable populations. And she's done a lot of that. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. She serves on a number of boards, including the Lake Forest Park Stewardship Foundation, the Jewish Giving Initiative for Teens, and the Seattle Jewish Community School, where she served for 9 years, three of those as president. So welcome to our guest here talking about care management. So Annie, I'm going to start with you. If you can tell us a little bit about your program and just some background on it.
Sure. But before I do that, I did want to say this because I am kind of a talker. So I have just a few notes here, but I wanted to say that this is always a really special treat for me to be on a panel with Natasha. She is and has been a beacon in the community related to interdisciplinary teaming in our community. She's tireless and tenacious. She serves on all these boards. She's on all these committees. She is brokering consistently with city council, police department, fire department, and she's always looking at the broader picture. And Bellevue is certainly very lucky to have her. And we as just a community in general are very lucky to have her. So I'm glad she's here today because her program has been up and running longer than ours has. So I just wanted to say that because I don't get often get a chance to be on a panel with Natasha. So I'm happy about that. So our program...
Thank you, Annie.
You betcha. Good to hear you. Our program, Mobile Integrated Health, started back in 2015 as a pilot program to try and reduce emergency room visits and frequent 911 callers. The model was set up with 4 firefighters. They had 2 cars. And they went out and met with citizens, and they quickly understood that not only were these folks medically complex, but they were also socially complex, and that reduction of ER visits and reduction of 911 calls is only one small facet. So they continued the pilot for several years, and then they enlarged it to include me. And I came in at that point. There were 3 firefighters that had retired. And so I was paired with Jody Denny, firefighter and EMT. And we worked together for several years. And then I have a new partner, and now we have another clinical social worker as well. So we are a 3-person team, Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. We receive our referrals from the firefighters post a 911 call. And we train them to have a very low bar for referrals to us, even if they've only seen a person one time and their intuition just tells them that they would benefit from ongoing follow-up from us. We can respond to scene. We get called frequently to an active scene as well. We don't traditionally take referrals from the community simply because already right now, we are on target to be over 750 referrals this calendar year, and there's only 3 of us, and we are actively out in the community. We see between 6 to 10 referrals a day. We have folks who have the majority, well, I should say half of our clients we see 6 to 12 times over the course of our interventions with them. Another quarter are between 12 and 24 times we see them. And the other quarter of folks we are seeing as sort of soft outreach case management for them over the course of their time in the community. Some folks we have to see on a weekly basis for wellness checks. They may live in very difficult conditions in the home and have decisional capacity, and they absolutely do not want to leave. So we go out and visit with them on a weekly basis, lay eyes on them, and give them that opportunity to have social contact. We, as a unit, say that we like to provide the right intervention at the right time. It's a very generalist approach. We certainly have specialty in mental health and substance use. However, our folks are varied, complex, a wide variety of issues. We have many people in our 4 district area that are aging in place, that don't have family, that live independently, and the pandemic has tipped it for them to where they went without much social interaction for such a protracted period of time that they now are beginning to fail medically, and so they're failing in their home as well. So there isn't anything that we won't do to engage folks. We operate from a strengths perspective, and we really want to get in there and not walk in with what the firefighters have told us about the individual, but find out what their story is, what their narrative is, what they imagine would help them in the short term, and then what they imagine will help them in the long term. Because we can go in with a plan and say, oh, well, you just do X, Y, and Z, like the firefighters want to do, right? Because that's how you fight a fire. You move from A to Z very systematically. But of course, you all know human behavior is not like that. So hopefully that gives you kind of a...
Thank you, Annie. That's fabulous. Natasha, can you share a little bit about your program? And then we'll get into just sort of an informal discussion and questions with everyone.
Sure. So hopefully, am I on screen now? Because I think I might be. Yay. Okay, good. So first, I want to apologize for my location. I am driving my son from New York to Texas. So I'm somewhere called Harrisonburg, Virginia at a Starbucks outside because it's really loud inside. So I may be by the drive-thru too. So I just apologize if there's a lot of traffic sounds, but I think it's quieter out here. I've been with the Bellevue Fire Department since 2014, and our program started in 2012. And from the beginning, it was a partnership between Bellevue Police and Bellevue Fire. And the original folks who started the program were looking for a program to address high utilizers of the 911 system. So folks who are calling frequently either for non-emergency reasons or for preventable reasons, similar to what Annie was saying, like older adults who are starting to fail and are starting to fall a lot, and maybe their partners no longer get them off the ground. So that was how the program started. When I came, and the program was modeled after a program in Spokane, which is a partnership between Eastern Washington's Graduate School of Social Work and the Spokane Fire Department. So their model was that they basically took MSW students who needed a lot of practicum hours, placed them in the fire department with an MSW supervisor. Firefighters would make referrals to them when they saw folks in the community that were calling a lot. And then students would go out to people's homes and do an assessment and try to address their needs in a different way by connecting them to resources that were more appropriate to their needs than a first responder. So that's the model that we were using from the beginning. When I came on, we did a program evaluation pretty early on, and our program evaluator sat down with the firefighters and some focus groups, and they said, we don't want this to be a high utilizer program. And there's two reasons for that. The first is that we don't mind going to see the same person for three times in one night. What we mind is leaving them in the same circumstances three times in one night and not being able to make a difference. And secondly, we don't want to wait till someone becomes a high utilizer if we see somebody the first time and we think that they could benefit from this program. We want to make a referral the first time. So similar to Annie, very low barrier entrance into our program as far as firefighters and police officers. They can make a referral about anything pretty much. Then the students go out and try to assess their needs. And then the students will basically provide case management for as long as needed. So until they get connected to another agency that's going to provide the services that they need, or in some cases, we'll work with folks forever until they die or move out of Bellevue. We have older adults living with mental illness. They're probably never going to get medicated or never get treatment. You know them. They get fired by many of their providers. And our goal is just to try to be a support to them, try to mitigate the damage they do to the relationships they do have with providers. And hopefully they will call us instead of 911. We are probably the only person who acknowledges their birthday every year with a card and a cupcake, and we just do what we can to support them. In 2017, we stood up a response unit, and that's staffed by four professional social workers who are in service from 8 to 5:30 daily, and they can be dispatched to the scene of a 911 call by police or fire who feel like it would be helpful to have somebody on scene. They will do whatever they can to mitigate the crisis in the moment, and then they will make a referral back to the students as any other first responder would. And then finally, over the summer, we actually piloted a program with the police department that I think will hopefully probably get funded for the 23-25 biennium, where we matched one of our social workers with a police officer who was plainclothes in a plane in an unmarked vehicle. All the police officers asked to be on the unit and received additional training. The goal was to be able to address sort of non-serious criminal crimes or non-criminal crimes, people who are really struggling with homelessness or substance use or mental illness, and try to provide a different kind of an outcome than basically the hospital or jail or leaving somebody where they are, which is the only options police have. So that was really very successful. The community liked it a lot, and our hope is that will get funded for next year. Great.
Thank you so much, Natasha. That's helpful. So we have two different programs. I've also heard in San Diego, Alzheimer's San Diego is working with the police department to do some training around what is dementia and how to work with people who have dementia. So there's that going on. And then Byron, I think you have worked, so you do want to talk really briefly about the work you've done, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Sure. Yeah, well, similar here, we have a crisis response team embedded in our police department and our police in San Antonio, and our police department and fire department co-mingle with this department, although it's headquartered out of the San Antonio Police Department. And that department has been around since the early 90s. And someone I taught with, Dr. Paul Furukawa, used to lead that team. And so those social workers are actually sent out into the substations. They're partnered with police officers. And then same thing, our Alzheimer's Association, which I'm on our board. For police training, there's a federal mandate that they get training every 2 years. San Antonio's police chief actually makes the officers go through a 40-hour training every year. He does double what is required. And in that, those 40 hours, they do, of course, their shooting and gun range stuff, but there's also training, crisis training, and Alzheimer's Association is part of that, where we teach them on, what is dementia, what to look for, what's an appropriate intervention. It's quick. It's a 45-minute session. So, but I've done some of that training with our police department and our sheriff's department. So,
great. So let's go ahead and open it up for our thoughts or questions to our guests. What are your burning questions?
I have a question. Maybe everyone has the same question. But what is the funding source for these two programs?
So our program, we receive funding through...
You're pretty likable.
Go ahead and put yourself on mute if you're not talking. Thanks.
So our particular program comes from King County funding. We got a small slice of the EMS levy that was passed. So that allows us to continue to move forward without concerns about financial security, at least within the next 6 years.
Natasha?
Same as Annie. For folks who don't know, the EMS levy funds our whole EMS system in King County and included $4 million for MIH programs in King County to stand up for fire departments to stand up or contract with another department for MIH services. And then we also are also in the general operating budget for the city of Bellevue and have been since about 2015. So about a quarter to a third of our budget is city operating funds, and the other three quarters is MIH funds from the county.
That's wonderful. Congratulations to both of you.
I see a question. What is your relationship with Adult Protective Services?
From our perspective, we work with them closely. We will oftentimes, too, if we've made contact with a citizen, we will oftentimes dovetail with APS and help them make a connection with the citizen as well. And we stay in during that time period and then oftentimes beyond, because APS, unless it's self-neglect, has time-limited perspective with the citizen.
Natasha?
I would say the same thing. We used to have a really great setup before they went to central intake that I loved and I'm sad does not exist. And when they did regional intakes, they would actually, basically what happens with our online intake is that folks can check a box, and that immediately when they make a referral to CARES, they make a referral to APS as well. And APS would get that and see it was Bellevue Fire CARES. And then they had only like two APS workers that were assigned to our cases. So we worked constantly together on cases, and it was an incredible collaboration. But that did not continue after they went to centralized intake, because they just couldn't manage it. So that's been a bit of a loss. So we still work with them, but it's not at the same sort of collaborative level as it was when we just had really close relationships with just a couple of workers.
Okay. Other other questions, or I'll go back to the chat. Let's see, one more question about have the hospitals noted a reduction in admission or ER visits?
So what the hospitals have remarked upon for us with people that we touch upon is that the vulnerability is reduced for the citizen. Most of the folks that we see just are so medically complex. They are going to travel into the ER. They are going to need emergency treatment. But there's a more of a level of stability with them is what I would say. But I will also say this. I worked in the hospital system for a long time. I know the language. I know what people can and can't do. And most of the time, providers can do quite a lot in the hospitals. But because of the pandemic and the fact that staffing was so overwhelmed and exhausted, and Natasha can speak to this too, but what we are experiencing now, our families, we're actually tracking folks when they get referred to us, if they go to the hospital, because when they come out of the hospital, oftentimes services, even though it was talked about by the care team, the services don't get set up for a variety of different reasons. And families come back and they will literally, then a family hand us a paper bag of all the paperwork from the hospital. They had no idea what to do, how to connect with services. And for them, touching upon mobile integrated health was the first time they felt really seen in the community and heard because the hospitals have been so busy. And we are experiencing, in particular, hospital social workers, and we're working on those relationships over and over again who say, that's not my role, I don't have time. And having worked in a hospital setting, they have time, they can make time, right? That it's super important to be able to look at the whole person. However, they are so overwhelmed. I get that too. So it's trying to kind of straddle that currently, I would say. So in dovetailing back to your original question, what ER social workers are reporting is that they are seeing more stability with the clients. I don't know that I would be able to say effectively that there have been reductions in visits.
Hey, quickly, before I forget.
No, but, you know, just to follow up on that, I think that almost what you're offering is transitional care management to some of these patients. And, you know, that's, I don't know that was your original goal, but that seems to be something that you're definitely offering that, of course, patients really need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Natasha, did you want to add anything to that?
I mean, I would just agree with Annie and say that, yeah, often what we are doing is trying to implement a discharge plan that gets lost. And I would say for, you know, we have complicated relationships with our ER social workers, and sometimes we actually have better relationships with the inpatient social workers because they better understand what we do. And there's a lot of turnover right now of the ER social workers, at least at our local hospital. So yeah, we're constantly trying to develop relationships with them. Our supervisor, the supervisor there and I have a fantastic relationship. We work very closely together, and sort of off the records, I take referrals from her. We don't take referrals from anybody outside of fire and police, except for her, because I know that she sees people over and over again that sometimes for whatever reason the firefighters have not made a referral for. So we're constantly working with them to try to, you know, be able to figure out how to give all the other thing that we're, that is have give them a lot of information that would be useful to them when we're bringing people to the hospital, because often, especially when we're talking about mental health crises, they don't see what we just saw in the community, and they're the ones who are evaluating whether or not to call the DCR. So we're always trying to work on better ways to document and to communicate that information to the team in the emergency department.
Yeah, that's really important, Natasha, we will call ahead and give a report, especially when the conditions in the home, the person appears to be functioning okay, but the conditions in the home are such, we know they will minimize that to the ER staff, and also just their fall risk alone with number of stairs in the home and just build up there too. So, and we too, this is why I love Natasha, we too also do off the record with two of the hospitals, their nurse care coordinators who are seeing people in and out, we will also take referrals from them and just go out and do check in with them in the community and start to build the relationship.
So what I'm hearing from you is that the two of you are really working hard to build relationships, particularly with the hospitals and those stable people in the hospitals, to make sure that you're serving the people who are identified as very vulnerable and needing some help, and that communication is going back and forth between you. And then Barbara asked, can you speak to how you approach these departments, I'm thinking fire and police, to start your programs? And maybe Natasha, you could talk about that first, since yours was developed first, and then Annie can share how. So for those of you who don't know the Seattle area, Bellevue and Shoreline are not that far apart. there's some in between, but there's a lot of we call it the east side and north part of Seattle. There is that collaboration that goes on between the different fire departments and police departments and mental health services. So Natasha, can you talk about how your program started?
So I wasn't there when the program started, and it really was started by basically the police volunteer coordinator, the EMS training lieutenant, and the public education person. So I would say that these days most police, or at least most fire departments, will know that they need an MIH program, want an MIH program, because honestly, MIH is the future of the fire department. We don't have fires anymore. People don't burn down very much. So I think we're going to be seeing the MIH programs get a lot bigger. What I would say, because I'm going to change the question a little bit to what I think is actually more relevant than trying to convince folks that they need the program, even for police right now. I think there's two pieces. One is the challenges of being a social worker inside the culture of police and fire, which are very, very different cultures. And it takes some time to learn that culture, but also to become trusted. So much of that inside police and fire, it's quote unquote a brotherhood. It's a family, and you're either in or you're out. And so much of the work we do relies on them trusting us and developing relationships. And there's a lot of attention needs to be put on that. It took years for me and for our program. And then the second piece is to convince them that they need social workers. Because a lot of programs start without social workers. They think that two AMPs can go do this work, or paramedics. And then eventually they decide that they do need at least one social worker. But I think that's the early on challenge, if you can get a department from the beginning to realize they need social workers. And honestly, a lot of that has to do with the union, and there's a lot of politics to go with it. But I think that is the biggest challenge, is to convince them that an EMT is not the person for this job.
Annie?
So trust is just the big issue, right? It takes a while for citizens to trust us, right? In working with them in the community and coming into a firehouse, they have to really trust that you can become a part of the team, and that they understand the skill set that you bring, and that your skill set is not better or worse than theirs. It's just different. So our union said, if you're bringing a social worker on, then we want that social worker to be compensated at union wages so that it's equitable with the EMT firefighter partner working with the social worker. which was a very progressive response. So they immediately pulled me into the union under what is called a non-uniform contract, yet I wear a uniform. But the uniform contracts are for firefighters, EMTs, and they did the same thing with the social worker, clinical social worker we brought on last year. So they immediately wanted that inclusion. And then we are embedded at Station 63 and we participate in chores. We every quarter come in and cook dinner for the crews and they participate with that too. We are constantly explaining to them what we do, why we do it. We are just a part of the team. We also want them to have realistic expectations too. We do trainings with them as well about how to make referrals, why, all of those pieces. And we also make sure that within, so we try to see our referrals within 24 to 48 hours, unless they go to a hospital setting. And then we double back and email the crews that made the referral so that they know that we are at least in the door and are starting to work, because in the fire department in particular, when they have to leave a person behind at the home, that is very difficult for them. When they know the individual is highly vulnerable and struggling, it doesn't feel good to leave them without a plan. So we double back with the communication there. If there's ever any issue related to conflict of any kind, we deal with it straight away. And we actually, it's been a very smooth transition for us. We absolutely feel like we are a part of the team. They always include us on a variety of different levels. So we feel very fortunate. The other three districts that we serve further north where we're not embedded, what we did was we just made ourselves visible. And so we would just randomly go by, I'm a talker. We hop by, we see everyone. How are you? This is what we do. Learning about people, learning about their families, just being connected. And then of course, once we did that, our referrals jumped high because people recognized us and knew that we could at least attempt to help.
Great. Thanks, Annie. I have a question. Are you working with, so in Seattle, it looks, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm thinking that in Seattle, they also have a nurse working on the team. Can you talk about?
Oh, sorry. They don't have a nurse in Seattle with Health One that I know of, but they do in Kent.
Okay.
Kent Cares has a nurse and a social worker. So all the MIH programs have a slightly different model or design just based upon community needs.
Okay, great. And do you talk to us if you know about how that works with integrating the nurse into those teams?
You know, I actually don't know how they have coordinated that. Natasha, do you have more information?
A little bit more. Okay. I mean, only that they actually pulled the EMTs off the teams and have nurses on instead of the EMTs, because I think what they found was it was a little bit of overlap, and a lot of what I think the nurses are doing is in some cases like is follow up care, is after hospitalization care like wound care or making sure that discharge plans again are being completed. And then they are also bringing their social worker out of the office and onto the rig, which they haven't had in the past. So they're focusing on some transition. I think the other thing, honestly, their program is partly funded by Valley Medical. So I think that, you know, they decided that a lot of what they wanted to focus on was folks that they were seeing with chronic health conditions. So that made sense to them, I think, to have nurses.
Mm-hmm. So I think what you're talking about, Valley Medical, for all of those who are not in the Seattle area, is a hospital that's now associated with the University of Washington. The population in that area is different than would be in Bellevue or Shoreline. So it sounds to me like they're adapting these programs to sort of meet the needs of the community that they're serving, right? And so it doesn't necessarily have to be one model or another. I'm thinking if you're looking at collaborating with folks, it would be a conversation about what's needed in the community and bringing all the parties together to talk about, you know, what population is being served, who are the stakeholders, and, you know, what are the needs, and maybe starting small rather than trying to go for a big program. As Natasha talked about in Spokane, it was mostly volunteers, student interns who were going out and doing the work and supervised by a clinical social worker and somebody who could sign off on their internship hours for their degrees. Is there a resource book for care management companies across the country that would be helpful for them to start these programs in different parts of the country? Do you know of anything like that? A resource book. It sounds to me like almost you have to go about it as a community organizer and start, you know, maybe talking to your city councils and or your fire and police departments somehow.
So the National NFP, the National Fire Protection Association, is the fire department's training center, and they actually started an MIH class right before COVID, and I was going to do it, and then I actually didn't end up being involved, and I'm not sure what came of it, but it would be worth checking out. So there is a resource for, I think, for departments that want to start MIH programs within their own training academy.
So, Natasha, when you talk about MIH, you're talking about the Integrated Health Team. Tell me what the acronym means for everyone.
Sorry, it's Mobile Integrated Health.
Thank you. Oh.
There is a book from long ago. So I think that this was back in the 2012 or so, but it's Mobile Integrated Health, MedStar Mobile Health. And it just talks about building a program and different how to do it as just an aside, but it's outdated too. So what I personally would say is that It is the wave of the future. And however much all of the different organizations want to talk about integrating services for clients, at least in Washington State, we do a really poor job of integrating services, both medical, social, mental health services for folks. And we require them to navigate when they don't feel well, when they are vulnerable. When they're in life transition, we are requiring them to navigate multiple services, and it is it becomes very difficult and impossible for folks. And many people don't have the money for private care management, so they will sometimes attach themselves to care management organizations that, like Choice, for example, that doesn't charge, but they have relationships with placement agencies. There's this gap, right, for people to be able to get that kind of solid care management service between what we offer and then private pay too. I would say that as well. But I think that fire departments in particular have a positive stereotype. And so if you could link with your fire district to be able to talk about the outreach needs in the community, then you could have other mobile integrated health teams in different parts of the country talk directly to the chief, for example, or for the board of commissioners for that particular district to talk about the success and the possibility with that program.
Thanks, Annie. I have a question about collaboration with other care management, whether it's private or nonprofit. Are you doing that, and how best to collaborate with the different care management services out there?
one of the things that we just try to do is to make sure that the linkage is successful for the person and that they are able to follow up with the care manager and case manager in that regard. We don't want to interfere with that relationship at all, simply support it. So when we work with people in the very beginning, we get a release of information, which is broad. And then we work with care managers, we work with case managers in order to make sure that the needs are being met for the citizen. And if there is any kind of resistance, or if, for example, the relationship is not going well, and we're hearing something in particular from the client, we'll help them sort of advocate for themselves related to that, and see if they can work through whatever difficulty they're having. So we'll do anything and everything. We just don't want to also be, we don't want to dilute the relationship too between the citizen and a care manager or a case manager.
Yeah. Natasha, did you want to add anything?
Only that we wish more of our clients were connected to some sort of care management or case management. It's unusual for us to have clients that are connected. And I mean, I would say the majority of our clients are on Medicaid. And so we do make referrals to their coordinators, care coordinators sometimes, to try to get them connected through their insurance company. But we find that most of the people that we work with don't have a lot of resources and are not well connected or even have access to care management or case management.
That's true.
What else? I see a question. Do you ever accompany clients to the ER or attend appointments, their medical appointments?
We definitely take people to clinic appointments as needed. We can't do it all the time. So they know that it's if they're not able to get a ride or if they've been disconnected from care and this is a sort of an opportunity to give them a warm transition back to the clinic to re-engage with services. We absolutely do that. We absolutely will attend appointments. They need us to take notes for them, or a family member is not able to go with them and they're concerned that they won't remember the information. Our unit is not allowed to transport to the emergency room because administrative staff would say if they need to go to the emergency room, then they need to go by aid car and they need to be assessed by two EMTs and traveled either by aid or medic. But the other we can do.
So because we're dispatched with the fire police, our professional social workers that are dispatched often go to the emergency department. Often they actually just meet them there because we don't respond with lights and sirens, so sometimes we can't get to the home fast enough to not miss them. So that happens all the time. The students don't go, and we don't transport, same for all the same reasons that Annie said. But and with the students can and will go to care appointments with their clients if that is what's helpful, and will transport if that's what's necessary. Sort of famous things what Annie was saying.
Great. I see a comment from Brenda. You provide an amazing service. We have teams focused on crisis mental health, but nothing like this. And Brenda, you're in California.
I'm in Pasadena. So we have our city has a program. Our county has a program. LA County has a bigger population, I think, than Washington and Oregon put together. Right. It is so big and so such lack of funds. And it's kind of amazing to hear what you do.
Does anyone else on this call, are you seeing programs like this in your community?
Our local police department north of Atlanta has a really active mental health response unit. It is not connected to the county sheriff's office particularly. There's a lot of politics in between those two departments. And then there are other small law enforcement departments. And it's a pretty fragmented effort at this point. I've been standing by and watching it and thinking, love y'all. And this is hard. It's something good, but it's not not the kind of response that you all are providing at all.
Anyone else see something similar happening or want to see something similar happening?
Obviously, we all want something similar happening. How does the funding come about, though?
So my understanding is in the beginning with the pilot program, it was funding through King County EMS, but then our funding currently is from the levy that passed. The EMS has a dedicated portion to MIH, so that secures funding for 6 years. Every community or every district is slightly different. We don't report to the city council in the same way that Natasha does. So it depends upon the area, but in general, the King County EMS levy is how we get our funding.
So what is MIH? Could you elaborate on that? I'm not familiar with MIH.
So MIH stands for Mobile Integrated Health, and we would describe it as non-emergency outreach post a 911 call, but also too, our unit is called to the scene to not only intervene and real time and be able to dismiss the other crews if needed, but also to assist them in coaxing someone to an emergency room should they feel they need it, but they're resisting it, et cetera. So we consider it non-emergency outreach to help stabilize a person in the community.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I see a question from Gladys. At any point did you have to develop a business case to prove in the proposed worth value of this initiative? For example, show that you can decrease the number of ER visits, decrease the revolving door of prospective clients. So just did you develop a business case or a business plan, put it in front of your city councils or somewhere else especially Natasha, because some of the funding comes from the city of Bellevue. So tell me about how you finagle your budget during that budgeting process, and tell us a little bit about that.
So we, first of all, the city council loves us because we're always good news. Like when we come to council, we're saying we're doing these wonderful things for the community, and they love hearing these stories. For us, it's really hard. I mean, as everyone knows, it's really hard to measure what doesn't happen, to measure prevention. We do have a few metrics that we report to the city every year. One of them is one that is, we use it because it's quantitative. I don't like it. It's really problematic. And yet we do it anyway. And that is that we track the number of 911 calls our clients have had 90 days prior to us seeing them and 90 days post case closure. And, from the beginning, our goal was always a 70% reduction in 911 calls. We have barely remained above, I think actually might have dropped to 69%. And the problem became that when we started seeing people the first time they had a 911 call, reducing from 1 to 0 is a lot bigger ask than reducing from 27 to 15. So we also look at the number of folks who have 0 calls after we see them post-case closure. That being said, people move. People die, all kinds of reasons. People stop calling, and we don't know always why they stop calling, so we're hesitant to take credit for it. But that it's still it's a compelling number to be able to share with our council. And then we also just have the numbers. I mean, just as Annie was saying, the numbers of referrals that we have has gone. I will give you an example that in March of 2020, we had 70 open cases. And that was the reason I know that is because all of our students were told that they couldn't come to practicum anymore. And the one other staff person who works in the office and I were looking at each other and asking, how are we going to manage 70 open cases? And I looked in March of 2022 and we had 270 open cases. So just the clear volume and need is, I think, compelling to the council as well.
Do you want to add anything, Annie?
Just that we count those numbers too. What I want to be able to say is quality of life and functioning, that someone can leave their home and actually go and visit a neighbor when they've been homebound, that someone can actually walk down the street and have the level of strength to come back to their home and not have, you know, additional falls. I mean, those are things that we look at all of the time. But in terms of numbers or councils or budgets, everybody wants to see reduction in ER and reduction potentially in 911 calls. I would say, though, that, you know, you fall, you're not able to get up, and there's family there. You don't want the family member to try and get you up. You don't want to get injured yourself when you're 85 and you're trying to help your 90-year-old husband, right? And so we want people to call 9112 so that they can get that service in the moment, even though it's technically a non-emergency lift assist. It's an emergency with that couple. So what I personally have always been on the lookout for is a way to measure the qualitative data, because that really speaks to the program. It's an all-encompassing program, and it's just essential. And with the pandemic, what we're seeing too is that services that used to be out there and available are much more limited now. The senior center, now they've opened back up for lunches, but maybe there are two people there. Maybe there are five people there for the classes when it used to be brimming with folks, right? I mean, the different services, more limited hours. And so people are really unsettled and restless. And it is, right now, it's so essential, but it's also, I think, essential in the long haul for communities, for wellness in the communities.
Thank you, Annie. Sure. We're coming to the end of our time here. I'm wondering if people have other questions. Are you open to hearing and helping them create some of these programs or answer questions in...
Can I just jump in? I just realized there's one more thing that I didn't think about because I keep thinking about fire. But on the police side for this over the summer, we did actually look at the reduction in use of force, the reduction in arrest, and the reduction in unnecessary ED visits. So those were specific that were both spoke to, you know, something that's quantitative and you could attach to dollars, but also to quality of life for the person who is getting something other than a use of force or a hospital visit or a arrest.
That's great. Yeah.
I want to say something to both, I believe Amy and, I'm sorry, I'm bad with names.
Annie and Natasha,
thank you. I almost want to see if they have like data and some kind of like a white paper can be done and they can actually publish it or even, you know, present it at our next NACCM conference so that many people could, you know, many counties, wherever all the CCMs are, could benefit from it and take it back to their counties and kind of sort of have a replication of this an amazing program.
Well, I can try to twist their arms next time we have a conference. It's a great idea. I'm not sure where our next national conference is, but if it's someplace fun, maybe we can get Annie and Natasha to agree to come and visit us.
Isn't it San Diego?
So San Diego.
It is.
Yes.
Just to be clear, this is NACM that we're talking. Yeah. This is the National Academy of Certified Care Managers. ALCA is a separate entity. Yeah. So obviously we have a ton of overlap. I think Julie and I have both served as past presidents for both boards. But yes, the ALCA conference, it will be in April in San Diego, California.
So we'll try to twist their arm and see their interest, and maybe we could get a whole panel of folks, Alzheimer's San Diego, also participating. So it looks like David says there's a program in Broward, Palm Beach area with a similar program. So Carol says, can we please get contact information for our speakers in case we need to contact them? Is that okay, Natasha and Annie? I'll put you on the spot.
Sure.
We'll go ahead and Julie Wagner and Sarah Garcia will have that information. You can contact them if you want to reach out to Natasha or Annie. Thank you all for coming. It's been a great conversation, and I'm glad you participated. Thank you, Natasha. Thank you, Annie, for your time and your wonderful information, and hopefully you're all inspired to go out and advocate for similar programs and to collaborate with these programs if you have them in your community. So I think all working together to support vulnerable populations is a goal we can all rally around. So thank you all. Stay safe.
Thank you.
And have
thank
a great day.
Thank you so much, Julie, for managing to put this together for us. We appreciate it.
Yes, and thank you, Annie and Natasha. We really
appreciate
you.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you.
Thank you for everybody at
Thanks
Nash.
For having us.
For everything you do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Barbara.